Evening, everyone. It's very nice to see a good mixed turnout this evening. Thank you very much for all for coming. I've been asked to speak from here rather than over there for audiovisual reasons. I first of all wanted to mention that we had about a fortnight ago, we had the joint meeting with the East of Scotland in Edinburgh. And for those of you that were there, I thought it was a very successful evening in some way, but there are lessons to be learnt in others, and particularly that the timing of the meeting was a bit, it all ran rather late for people to travel a long way to trains. But however, the good news is that if we run it next year, it'll be at this end rather than the Edinburgh end, so it'll be less inconvenient. But we'll certainly give any ideas that you've got of ways of improving it. We'll certainly take it on board. So do speak to myself or to Lars. Could I introduce this evening Chris Sinclair, who's very kindly come all the way from Middlesbrough. Middlesbrough is a wee bit like Glasgow in that it's in the process of a lot of redevelopment. And I was mentioned to Chris that my memory of Middlesbrough was visiting it on a naval ship, because most people don't even realise it's a port, but it's I visited a naval ship about 30 odd years ago, and we put a football team against the Middlesbrough Women's Police Force, it was a very amusing afternoon and a very good evening after that as well. Chris is a part of a multi-professional team, a big multi-professional team. Now she was telling me that they're about to appoint a fifth consultant and a lot of other professionals. She's the clinical manager of this team, and in this role has been very much involved in both developing secondary and also the liaison with primary care nurse-led clinics. It's very much in the news at the minute, all this sort of thing, and we're absolutely delighted that you've come all the way up from Middlesbrough to speak to us about it, Chris. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that introduction. And thank you for inviting me here to Glasgow this evening. It's really nice. Unfortunately, I won't get to see very much of it. I've experienced a traffic jam on the M8. And I've had a very pleasant journey up here. Also, thank you for those people who heard my talk in York and felt it was worth coming to talk to you about it as well. And the clinic I manage in Middlesbrough is multi-professional. We're just about to appoint our fifth consultant. And we have a number of nurse specialists, full-time physiotherapy, pain management programme, clinical psychologists, and a team of secretaries to help us out as well. So it is quite a busy clinic, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go along. But the reason and the purpose of the talk this evening is to raise awareness, and I've sort of delivered this talk to a number of groups around the country now, and it's looking at how we sort of utilise the clinic more effectively and more efficiently, and pretty much in line with government targets, and having to do more work really with less resources. And that's been quite difficult for us, but not to be beaten, I started to think out of the box and decided that we could rise to the occasion as we needed to. And it seems to be working very well. There's a few little caveats at the end that are a bit worrying at the moment with the political climate, and I'll talk about them a little bit later on. So like everything, we've been caught out in a little bit in a number of ways, but we'll see how it goes. That's probably one of the better features of Middlesbrough. That's the transporter bridge, and for those of you that watched Alfreda Zempeta a couple of years ago, it still is in Middlesbrough, not in South America, and it's actually quite nice. And yes, Middlesbrough is being developed a bit more, and hopefully it'll be as grand as Glasgow one day. Who knows? The James Cook University Hospital is a big tertiary centre. In the pain clinic, we get approximately 1,500 new patient referrals a year for chronic pain. And on the acute pain side, we see 250 patients a month inpatients. And we're finding that on the acute pain rounds now, it's hard to call them acute pain rounds all of the time, because in actual fact, we have so many complex chronic pain problems that are sitting around on the wards. And with having to optimise bed space and move patients through the system more quickly these days, the acute pain team spends a lot of time actually being referred to these chronic complex situations on the wards. And we do involve the other professionals within our team to help us with that. So we're quite diverse and we hopefully offer quite a broad service. The aim of what we're going to talk about this evening really is some of the issues in chronic pain, which I know won't be of any news to anybody, but just really to focus us and get the whole idea in perspective as to why we needed to think about different ways of working. And really how we went about commissioning a new sort of service. The model we used, which, as I say, things are changing all of the time with the political climate and the NHS agenda, so we have to keep refining the model in line with what's going on. And really how we run a primary care-based nurse-led service. And there's a little bit of data at the end just telling you about some early evaluations. So I hope that gives you a flavour of what we're going to do this evening. Some of this information was taken from the Pain in Europe survey, and it's, once again, it won't come of any surprise to you, the prevalence of chronic pain and how devastating the effects of chronic pain are. And like myself, a lot of you have worked in pain clinics and pain management for a number of years, and you start to see over the years patients who may return, patients who have been inappropriately managed and perhaps badly managed in the wrong area of healthcare. And the statistics tell us that it's actually a much greater problem than a lot of the general public and often a lot of general practitioners think. And I've talked about these statistics in general GP surgeries, and they often raise an eyebrow. And I don't know whether that's because they're alarmed by the statistics or they don't actually believe what I'm saying. But if we listen to some of this data from the Pain in Europe survey, it is actually quite alarming. So a large percentage of patients with arthritis and osteoarthritis, which may not always get referred to the pain clinic, I think GPs feel that it might not be an appropriate referral, and they may or may not manage that appropriately within the primary care setting. So a lot of suffering going on there. Something that we found that was particularly disturbing was the time taken to often achieve adequate pain control. And when you think that some patients can be a number of years, 2-3 years, before they actually turn around and say, well, you have made a difference and I feel like I've got my life back. And sometimes it's too late for them to even say that because they forget what it was ever like to have a life without pain. And sometimes GPs will say, well, why will it take 2 years to, you know, find an effective way of managing the pain? But when you think of they might spend a year going backwards and forwards to the GP, and then some of the lengthy waits to come to the pain clinic. I don't know how you're running at the minute. We have to see our patients within 13 weeks at the minute, and it really has taken some time to get to that target. And we've been forced into it with the government targets, and we've had to do initiative clinics and that sort of thing. And we've only really achieved it because of our primary care interest. But 6 months ago, we were still at 17 weeks. And when patients come at 17 weeks, 13 weeks or whatever, they then still have to go through a number of management options, treatment management options, before they can actually start to achieve some sort of pain relief, some sort of normality, some sort of function and restoration. And that is for the ones that are motivated by, as you know, a lot of these patients at this time are struggling to actually get back on with normal life. 69% of primary care organisations having no guidelines, no recommendations, and, you know, GPs, I'm sure, offer patients a very good service. They are general practitioners. They are not pain specialists. And when patients turn up to them with pain, I think they try and manage as best they can. But in our experience, their understanding of analgesics, where to start on the analgesic ladder, appropriate use of opiates, we find that all of that is, in our area anyway, we found that that might be lacking or not as well understood as it possibly could be. So some of these things were making us think about what we needed to do. And once again, there's no surprises to any of you. The impact of chronic pain is obviously quite devastating. I think the biggest impact, apart from that which it has on the individual's lifestyle, is the actual cost of the NHS alone. And as we know, the NHS is struggling badly with funding. Our particular trust at James Cook is one of the worst offenders in the country. We had a £35 million overspend a year ago, and we're on a financial recovery trek at the minute. So the means of sort of trying to reduce some of this insidious cost to the health service is actually a responsibility of all of us, I think. Looking at some of the socioeconomic issues. One in five parents suffering people having lost their jobs. Unemployment is bad in our part of the world anyway. And to compound that further by not treating patients' pain appropriately is once again irresponsible as a professional. Sick time is another problem. And then the other knock-on effects of depression and relationship issues and social problems is quite devastating. So untreated pain is bad news, and obviously the cost to the NHS alone is devastating too. So in treating it, a multidisciplinary approach, I think we all agree, is the way to go, and I think we need to all look at what the individual disciplines can offer from consultants, nurses, therapists, etc. There are a lot of inconsistencies, I think, and that is due to a lot of misunderstanding, ineffective treatments, or treatments inappropriate. They might be the right treatment, but they might be the wrong time. And when somebody's perhaps waited maybe 6 months before they get to see a pain specialist, they may get what would have been the right treatment 6 months ago, but at 6 months down the line, it could be that they've got other psychosocial issues that are preventing them from moving on with their treatment. So early education of the patient, of GPs and the carers, we felt also was another driving force to look at different ways of doing things. We looked at what was happening in secondary care, and we felt, do all the patients who have simple pain need to come to the hospital? I think I was just chatting to a colleague earlier on, and said that years ago we had a different idea altogether. Every patient that went to the GP with pain, the pain clinics were becoming very prevalent, and I think the GPs were saying, well, we'll send you to see the pain clinic. And I think GPs, you know, probably thought, well, that is where these patients need to go. But they were coming and perhaps waiting 13, 17, 21 weeks, whatever it was, to have step one of the analgesic ladder explained and prescribed, and perhaps TENS machines. They probably didn't need to come into secondary care with all the problems of that, the setting up of appointments, the driving to the hospital, parking. Our DNA rate was quite high as well, and a lot of these things were fairly prevalent in terms of the reasons why. What did we do with the patients in secondary care that we couldn't have done in the community? Well, very little, really. They could have got a prescription at the GP. They could have had a TENS fitted in a practice. They could have had health promotional education. They could have had even pain management groups, self-help groups. Action on pain is something that we use quite a lot. And these are all things that are happening independently of secondary care. And what else happens when they come to hospitals? They get into the sick role. They start to label themselves. They're on the sick. They're under the consultant. They're waiting for the hospital. So they don't go to work. And I think they feel that they have to sort of play the game. They get into the sick role, they continue to hobble and be inactive and lay in bed and this sort of thing. They become quite medicalised. And we felt perhaps we were medicalising pain more so than it needed to be. And of course, the other problem for us was that we had a lot of complex chronic pain problems that weren't getting in soon enough. Our four consultants that we currently have all subspecialise in other areas. Paediatrics, genitourinary pain, facial pain, neuromodulation with dorsal column stimulation. And those sort of patients that were requiring very specialised pain management were also waiting just as long. So we were starting to see that there was a need to move some of the patients elsewhere so we could concentrate on what we were doing. So although it was patient-focused, it actually met the targets as well. So it had a patient focus to it, and it had a sort of a target, a performance issue to it. And that felt very comfortable to me, being both a manager and a nurse, because as a manager, I didn't want to lose sight of the clinical, patient-focused part of my role. And as a nurse, I had to think, well, you've got to put that aside sometimes and think about how we perform as an organisation, and how we were managing our financial recovery plan as well. So, and as you know, activity equals funding, and that was helping as well. So there was two sides to it. So I think from yourselves, the message I'm trying to get over to you is that if you're putting proposals together for something like this, you can look at both the patient side and the performance side in tangent, and you can actually then put a very robust proposal together to commissioners when you're looking at developing a service like this. It doesn't seem just one-sided to either clinical care or performance. So we thought of new ways of working, and we had to start basically sitting down with a blank sheet of paper and thinking, how are we going to manage our targets, manage our patients within the same sort of resourcing that we got? And on this financial recovery plan, we had to make a 5% staff saving as well. And we actually ended up losing a whole time equivalent nurse specialist and reconfigured the whole of our service in order to put more nurses onto the chronic side to see do more clinics. And we had to sort of rob a little bit from the acute side. And given that the number of referrals on the acute side with complex pain on the wards was increasing as well, we had to really sit down and have a good think about it. So some of the things that were driving forces for us were obviously the targets, the capacity within the clinic. Obviously, the consultants that work in the pain clinic have so many sessions for pain and other sessions for anaesthetics. So we didn't have any more clinics, and we had to try and think what we could do without using premium rate initiative money to see more patients. So we had to free up capacity some way. It was very obvious to see that when we looked at the referrals, the nurses who were working with the consultants were saying, I could have seen this on my own, I could have done this elsewhere, they didn't need to wait to see a consultant. And by this time the nurses were developing their skills, and two of them went off to do prescribing courses, and they were working as consultant multipliers within the clinic, really. So if the consultant had a clinic with a nurse, he could double up his numbers. So that was working very well straight away. But of course, given that these nurses have been working in chronic pain management for 4 and 5 years, they had the skills and experience to do that. It's a specialised area, and we had to be very careful at bringing in any new staff that they weren't subjected to working beyond their level of competency and their remit. So we had to be very careful not to over-egg the pudding. There was a number of financial constraints, obviously, with the deficit in finances within the trust. And other services we're developing within our pain clinic, such as the neuromodulation, dorsal column stimulation, and taking on the other subspecialties. So putting it all together, we had a bit of a plan, thinking, well, this is what we need to do. Some of it was creative, some of it was a need to do because of finance and targets. But we felt we had a good, robust proposal to present to commissioners within the PCTs. As I said earlier, there was a number of devastating impacts from the effects of chronic pain, the financial side, what it does to the patients, and then we were faced with it within a clinic that was getting more and more stretched with its resources. So we started saying, OK, let's keep this in perspective. Could we just leave things as they are, and we'll just work a bit hard and we'll try and see more patients? We won't really change anything. Could we expand secondary care? Could we sort of put more to GPs? Could we put nurses into primary care? The do-nothing option, I think, is probably, at best, it's not going to change anything, but I think at worst it's probably irresponsible in a sense. When you look at the data from things like the CSAG report, the European Pain in Europe survey, I think it rests with you not particularly comfortably as a professional, because you think, well, if that's really what's happening, I feel if you're passionate about your specialty, you really have to feel that there's better ways of doing things and for patients to be seen sooner. And with the managerial hat on, I really have to do this within a budget. So doing nothing wasn't really an option. Expanding secondary care pain service, great if you had the money. Another consultant, another couple of nurses, another clinic room, secretary, that's fine. But as you know, it's expensive and it's not always appropriate, because as we said, the patients might get to see a specialist sooner, but do they need to be coming to hospital, as we said before, getting into the sick role, probably intensifying their problem out of the proportion that it needed to be. So we felt that keeping the secondary care services for the patients that needed it most was perhaps a better idea. And nowhere was there going to be any money to expand secondary care any further. Educate the GPs, well, with no disrespect in terms of their level of education, but in terms of giving them more pain management support. We had made a start at that with sort of internet advice about analgesia. From the industry, we were getting a lot of support to take out to GPs. Speaker meetings, I was involved with a number of meetings talking about management of chronic pain. And that's fine. I think GPs embraced it as much as they could. But as I say, they are generalists. They've got lots of other things to deal with. And with the new GMS contract and points, etc., pain didn't figure as highly as many other conditions did. And we didn't feel that the GPs were perhaps taking on board as the amount of information that they would feel comfortable with to prescribe things like higher doses of opiates, gabapentin, the amitriptyline route, that sort of thing. And things like TENS machines, you know, it was a bit of a nursey thing and there would have to be time for practice nurses to do all of that. So giving things back to the GPs was an option, but it maybe perhaps wasn't going to be something that would happen within a short space of time. So we didn't think of another option, so there wasn't a fifth, but this fourth one we felt was probably the most workable. And as I say, the experienced nurses we had in the clinic, the nice thing was they'd grown up in the clinic, they'd worked with the consultants, they were very expertise in their knowledge and skills, and they had the appropriate level of accreditation to go with that. And we felt that that was probably the most effective way of doing that. Not losing sight, of course, of the fact that we didn't want to alter the concept of healthcare in pain management inappropriately. And when we looked at a sort of a tier system of how patients should be managed, what we were having at this particular time was that the majority of patients, if you look across the bottom tier, majority of patients should be having over-the-counter self-help support groups. As I said, Action on Pain, being able to turn to a pharmacist, have written information, to be able to manage simple acute pain conditions. And the majority of patients should be able to do that. And I think to the informed, the educated, the professionals, we know how to manage simple pain, and we would do that. But there's a lot of people, and particularly in the area around Middlesbrough, we found that there wasn't enough people who could actually have self-help. And that really needs to be promoted. The next level was GP, and there should be another sort of reducing level of patients who have to go to the GP, and there should be a further reducing level who actually then go on to use the specialist nurse, the GP with special interest, the musculoskeletal units and the pharmacist, and there should only be really a very small percentage that actually need to come to secondary care. However, this is how it is at the moment, unfortunately, that the majority of patients are in that bottom tier and they're coming into secondary care. They're then filtered down to the specialist nurse, to the GP. And then at the top of the tree there's only a small proportion who are actually into self-care and support groups. And we're trying to turn the whole thing on its head, really. We're probably maybe not even halfway, but maybe sort of a third of the way between the two at the moment. But I'd like to think that in another year we could be at least halfway there, and that we raise awareness enough to be able to have a lot of people who are at the bottom of the triangle and are actually managing simple pain problems themselves. So we'd managed to create our vision by this time. We'd looked at all the various problems, we looked at what we were facing, we looked at what we would like to do, and we tried to refine it. And we looked at some of the concept drivers, such as the performance targets, etc. And this was the vision. We said we would take a clinical nurse specialist to work alongside community staff, both GPs and practice nurses. And they would provide advice, education, carrier caseload, link into secondary care, and remain with access to the consultants. We didn't want the nurses to be from primary care with our advice and support. We felt that they had to be mindful of a multidisciplinary team within secondary care and would still work along alongside the consultants. We felt that this was probably safer for patients and more appropriate for the GPs that would be using them as well. We'd give early contact with the pain clinic practitioner and start to reinforce positive messages, so looking at sort of the self-help concept, really. And obviously on the performance side, reduce the waiting times in secondary care. And hopefully those complex patients that needed to come into us would get in sooner. So that was the vision. We sat down with PCTs for a while and started to look at what they wanted as well. and what were the issues. And this is something that you need to perhaps do when you're starting to look at developing a model like this. We made it a little bit protracted for ourselves in the beginning. I think we went along with a preconceived idea of how it should be. But what you do need to not lose sight of when you're developing the idea is what actually do the GPs and community staff want. And that may vary from location to location. So what would be required in this area of Scotland may be quite different to what would be required in, say, the southern points of England or somewhere. We have to look at what you're actually dealing with and what people want. And what they already have. I mean, we found that there was musculoskeletal clinics already managing acute back problems and that sort of thing. And there was a little bit of tension in the early days because I think the physiotherapists thought that we were going to just come along and sweep their service off its feet and take over their patients. And I think they felt a little bit threatened in some of the earlier days. I think the GPs also felt a little bit, perhaps not threatened, but a little bit troubled by the fact that we were coming out and telling them, or, you know, sort of assuming that we would tell them how to manage some of their patients. So it was sort of trying to get the relationships right in the beginning as well. And I think really we just said, asked the question, who best meets the need? You know, where do these patients need to be seen and who can do that most appropriately? The concept of the gypsy concept for GPs with special interest became predominant as well. But we only actually have one in Middlesbrough for a large area. And that's a chap that takes on pain management referrals within community, and he's an acupuncturist as well, and we work quite closely with him and refer patients to him for acupuncture. So there's good relationships with him, but at the time he wasn't particularly interested in expanding his role any further. He wanted to keep a big generalist side to his role as well. So there is some discussions going on at the moment as to whether other GPs might actually go for this gypsy in pain management. The big pair part of it, you know, does it sort of come out of the PCT purse alone, or what is the cost of secondary care? And we had to look at that. And when we initially set to with the clinics, we actually managed to get off the starting blocks with some commercial funding. And we had commercial funding for a whole year in one PCT. And that was a bit of a risk, really, because we got that money to put the nurse into primary care for 1 year. Now, that we're fairly confident that it would work, but if the funding was pulled, it was quite risky to turn around then and say, well, these patients then are left high and dry, or the service is pulled after 1 year. But we spent a lot of time working with them, and they had other sort of priorities at the time, so we had to be very careful that we met their right sort of objectives. And fortunately, after a year, the service evaluated so well that they felt that they couldn't possibly stop the pain management service. So they actually funded it now, and that's great. And one of the other PCTs we're working with, they decided they wanted to fund it themselves from the beginning. And the other issue as well that you have to negotiate with the GPs and the PCT is really on what scale would it be available. Because the way it works, as I'm going to come on to explain, is that really this nurse is only spending half of her time in primary care because she spends the rest of her time in secondary care, keeping those skills, working with a consultant. So you've got to ask yourself, how does one nurse with just 2.5 days a week actually see the scope of pain referrals across the whole PCT? But I'll come on to how that will sort of work. So given that we've started to get our proposal listened to, and we went through a number of meetings, and some of them were pointless and futile, but some of them we started to actually get somewhere, it was really about their priorities as well, because we had our targets, we had our priorities, we had things we needed to do, but it was the same in PCT. They had various objectives for every year that they had to meet, and what was the financial objective to them might have been different for ourselves, same with clinical and performance and various standards. And The particular sort of objective that we managed to get this through on was they had an improving access objective that they had to meet for that particular year. So getting patients to be seen sooner, closer to home, closer to the GPs, actually met their improving access target. So that was where we got in on that one, really, which was really useful. And of course, we didn't realise what all that was about at the time. So you need to understand their language and be clear what all of that's about. And if you know what their sort of access targets are and what's going on in the world of PCT, you probably can sort of beef up your proposal a lot more, because you know which bells you need to ring, which boxes you need to tick. And it was actually a little bit different out there than it was in secondary care. So there was a big learning curve really in those days when we were developing the proposal and having the meetings. But really, it was about also emphasising the need for chronic disease management. Pain as a chronic disease isn't as well defined as many other chronic diseases. But people are living longer. Their pain problems may get worse as they get older. And people can maintain much more independent lifestyles if they're not living with pain. And as the elderly start to become more dependent, managing their pain is a good socio-economical thing to do, and it was about emphasising all of that as well. But it was difficult, because I think even in the land of the PCTs, where you're dealing with people who are non-clinical a lot of the time, they didn't understand that chronic pain was a lifelong condition. The public, the lay people, the non-clinicians, they understand that things like diabetes is lifelong and that epilepsy is lifelong, but they often think, like patients do, that pain is limiting and that, oh, well, it'll get better one day. Well, you know, we know that it won't, and we know that patients have to adapt their lives to live with it. And it came as quite a surprise to me at first that people working in healthcare in quite high positions had limited understanding of the clinical consequences of not doing something appropriate. So I think you've got to be quite blunt, really, that they've got to understand that what is the condition they're dealing with. And not having a national service framework doesn't help us with that. So we got things developed, and we got as far as developing a nurse-led clinic, and we started to look at what it should look like. And for us, I mean, it does differ from place to place. There are a few other clinics around that we know of, but we felt that this is what our nurse-led clinic should look like. But we wanted a practitioner who's been developed within the multidisciplinary team, given that they're doing, you know, multifactorial assessments, having to understand a little bit about the biopsychosocial model, understanding the psychological aspect of chronic pain, how it affects people socially. We felt that we needed somebody who's seen that regularly alongside consultants, who understand how the chronic pain person ticks, those who are going through litigation, those who've had claims, those who have been on the sick a long time, trying to sort of, you know, somebody who understands how that mindset is in that person. We wanted to have the role pivotal between the two areas, primary and secondary care, and also involve musculoskeletal services. As I said, we felt we went out naively thinking that we would sweep up all these acute, simple back pains, but a lot of them were being managed by physiotherapists in primary care, and it was important that we made links and worked with them. And that works well now, and there's a lot of internal referrals between musculoskeletal and pain. Clinical management plans were something that had to be developed at the time, and one of the PCTs was most insistent on them and felt that the nurse couldn't be launched into actually seeing patients until they had a robust clinical management plan. And that was something really that was developed with tangent with the consultant in the clinic. And it was a case of if a nurse wanted to use certain drugs, certain therapies, if it was in the clinical management plan, either the GP would sign it or the consultant would sign it, and then the nurse would work from that, a little bit like a patient group directive, that there was an understanding between the clinician and the nurse that this was the process for the patient's treatment. In actual fact, they've relaxed it now, and from April they've said the clinical management plans will go and they don't have to use them. I don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing, but the nurses felt comfortable working within a plan. But the two nurses that we've got working out there at the moment are experienced and understand the plans okay, but I think nurses coming into the role would probably do better if they've got that safety net of a clinical management plan. And some areas might continue to use them, we'll have to see. Don't forget the other things I would say when you're developing this service, such as secretarial support. Somebody needs to set up the clinics, make the appointments, type the letters. It's not just about a nurse being out there. You would lose a lot of nursing clinical time if the nurse had to see to all of this as well. And when you're putting in the bid for the funding, don't forget to include things like travelling expenses, TENS machines, things like that. It's important that you upfront from the beginning about what it will actually cost. It's easy to just say, oh yes, our nurse will come to your clinic and see a raft of patients for you. But to do it properly, you need to have the fundamentals of a service and make sure that that's protected and built in. And also some time for the nurse to do some education. She needs her own education time, and we assigned a session a week, and that's for her to have some administration time and education, and also to educate other people. So what she does is try to set up meetings with GPs, with practice nurses, and spreads the word a little bit there. The sort of benefit in that, really, I guess, is that GPs start to understand and become confident in prescribing or using various pain management therapies sooner. And also for the practice staff as well, our further vision is really is to see practice nurses who can perhaps review medication, fit a TENS machine and review that. And hopefully what we'll have in the future is a practice nurse based in GP surgeries who almost run a mini pain clinic and have the specialist nurse as a sort of a roaming consultant who will be pivotal and do various clinics around the area. And as I was saying earlier, how did we manage the scope of the scale of what we were proposing? Well, that in a way is how we would probably do it. Have a model clinic in a few areas around the PCT, and then as they become more familiar with pain management, then we could move on to other areas and leave perhaps a GP and a practice nurse who have that specialist knowledge and eventually build up a network around the PCT. And they've got the nurse there for constant liaising with by telephone, and she can then consult the consultant in the pain clinic. So you've got a whole network really across primary and secondary care rather than just have isolated pockets of good practice. And ideally a successor. The difficulty for me was from managing this was the fact that I had to relinquish the nurse's role for half of her time in secondary care and put her out into primary care. But there was still all of that work going on in secondary care, so who does that? So you have to bring in your successor sort of fairly early on, really, so that she becomes experienced, she or he rather, becomes experienced to then backfill the person that goes off into primary care. So you've got this constant cycle of staff coming through. So it's an ideal development role for nurses coming into pain management. And we've now got to the point where we're ready to almost launch the third nurse, because we've got two working out in primary care half of the time. We had one person come in to backfill them. She's now ready to take on the third PCT, because we have four PCTs who feed into our clinic. And we're now talking about it in the fourth one, and looking at how that nurse will be backfilled. But it's a case with the PCTs, it's like chicken and egg, really. You need the money off them to get your successor in before you can let the other one out, but they don't want to give you the money till you let that one out. So it's a bit of a juggling act, really. So a lot of negotiation skills are very useful. So what happens in the clinic when you eventually get that far? Well, our nurses triage all of the referrals that come into the pain clinic, and they use a referral guideline. The GP has some referral guidelines, both on the internet and a hard copy, and a very simple piece of paper with a tick box. That was a bit of a debate as to how to do that, because a lot of GPs, when we spoke to them about this idea, went, oh, don't start giving us lots of paper to fill in and letters to write. Keep it simple. But the only thing with keeping it simple is sometimes you get inappropriate referrals, so the nurses have to be very clever at reading between the lines. But they've tried to make the pro forma very simple so that there's enough detail to get a good triage, but it doesn't take too long for it to be done. So they triage the patients, and that's actually been, when I was saying at the beginning, there's a couple of caveats here about how you have to be aware of what's going on. Fortunately, managed to keep our nurses doing the triaging. One of our PCTs has got this clinical assessment service where non-clinicians look at referral forms from all specialties that come through the PCT and then direct them, signpost them to the various places in secondary care. Now, we were quite worried that somebody else might triage the pain referrals, A, because they might be inappropriately signposted, even though they had a guideline with them, but secondly, the latest issue is the PBR, payment by results. And we, as you know now, will get paid for the activity that goes in secondary care. Primary care, really, we're a little bit worried because they've now got nurses out there, and if they want to use that service because it seems to them cheaper and they don't have to pay for the activity coming to secondary care, we were concerned that they would then direct all of the pain referrals into primary care and we wouldn't get paid for our secondary care services. So we have to be very careful with that. But fortunately, our own nurses are triaging, so they will then cream off the ones that are definitely for primary care and hopefully the complex referrals or the more intermediate to complex referrals will go into secondary care. But we'll have to keep an eye on that because we do feel that the PCTs will want to be very protective of services they've got out in primary care and use them before they use secondary care. So that is a note of caution when you're setting up your clinic, that we don't let too much go away from where it needs to be. So these nurses still belong to us, fortunately, and that's we feel that that's probably a plus thing. So just a word of caution if you're setting that up. We didn't know that at the time. I needed a crystal ball, really. And had I seen that, we might have thought, how much of this needs to go out there? Because what we did in all good faith in managing both the clinical side and performance. But now we're not sure if we've shot ourselves in the foot just a little bit, but we'll see. At this clinic, then, they get a complete assessment of all the factors affecting the patient with pain, and that is assessment tools that the nurses have set up, and they have that time to do that. And I think this is what the GPs liked about it as well. I mean, you know yourself the time it takes to do a multifactorial assessment on somebody that's been in pain for some time and how it's impacting on their life. And GPs really, with a 7-minute consultation, I think, which is probably the most they probably get, don't really have the time to talk to the patients about how it's affecting their life. And I think because of that, they don't prescribe appropriately, because I don't think they feel they can justify some of the more potent drugs or some of the other drugs that we use in pain management, because I don't think they get enough of a history and enough of a picture that's going on to actually justify the prescribing. So I think once if they'd sat in clinic and listened to patients how we have to for half an hour, 40 minutes, they can get a full picture and think, yeah, I really can see where this guy's coming from now and what we need to do. And that is the advantage that the nurses have out there. They've got that time to do that. And the GPs like that. They say, well, if you're finding that information out, I feel more happier working in tandem with you, doing the prescribing that you suggest. I think early education of the patients is particularly important. As we said earlier, this self-help business, getting them to manage and understand that they can still move around, they can go to work, they can still do some normal activities with only just slight limitations, rather than just become a sick person who can't work and who can't function normally. And I think when patients understand that, and our nurses say to us, you wouldn't believe how many patients think that if they pull a muscle in their back or they've got headache or they've got some abdominal pain, that they have to become a sick person. And yes, we know that there are psychological issues that sometimes drive that, but a lot of patients just become very fearful of pain. A lot of the patients that are seen might be early discharges from hospital, patients that have had surgery, they're put through the system very quickly these days, and they're very fearful about physio and rehabilitation. And I think this is where some of the community staff can work very collaboratively with the pain nurses to get advice on how the medication can be stepped down and what they can and can't do. So the education part of it is actually crucial. And looking at the sort of CBT approach to their actual lifestyles. TENS is used very widely in the primary care clinics, as you can imagine, and that's introduced at a very early stage, and the outcomes on that are very good, and I've got some outcome data to show you. And the medication is actually a sort of one of the last resorts, really, in the primary care. I think the GPs and the PCTs were very fearful at first. There'd be far too much prescribing. The nurses would rush out there with prescription pads and that their drugs bill would escalate. But our nurses are saying that they can actually manage a lot of these patients with good advice, TENS, simple medication, over-the-counter stuff, and that's working particularly well. But patients who are having sort of more potent medication, drug titration clinics and titration reviews, it's very useful to do these there as well. And what we've also done is developed the nurse-led review titration clinics within secondary care as well. As a prescribing consultant, and you've seen a patient and you might not see them for 4 or 5 months again because of your review times, if it's anything like ours, you might be quite uncomfortable with prescribing opiates if perhaps you can't get to see your patients again for another 3 or 4 months or even longer. So the nurses doing these titration reviews in either primary or secondary care is great, and a lot of our consultants will see the patients in the clinic, and if it's opiates, they'll send them into the primary care clinic to have that reviewed. And the GPs are starting to follow that model as well, which is really good now. Alongside that, it's conquered the fear of opiates a bit, we feel. We feel that they're used more appropriately, that patients can be monitored more closely, and we can do more assessments of what's going on and manage any problems and side effects. When I've done meetings to GPs and talked about chronic pain and appropriate management of it, when we've got onto the subject of opiates, there's been a lot of sort of grumbling and things like that. And one GP actually said to me, I think it's an absolute travesty that patients who don't have cancer end up on morphine. And I just said, well, I think it's a travesty that patients who have chronic pain and can't live with it don't end up on some sort of strong pain killer, be it whatever it is. And he said, well, that's because you work in a pain clinic. It's easy to prescribe from there. So there was, you know, you get this sort of thing from time to time. But I think when they see that, I think what their fear was, and although there's fears of addiction, things like that, I think their greatest fear, because of shipment, etc., was that if they prescribe opiates and patients have some devastating side effects, it'll be a bad reflection on themselves. But they felt, majority of them said, they would feel much more confident prescribing stronger medication if the patient was being reviewed more regularly. So that's been very useful. So what else happens? Well, as I said, working collaboratively with musculoskeletal has been very useful. I think the nurses have learned from that a lot, and I think the physiotherapists have learned from it too. It's now become a nice relationship. It started off a little bit sort of contentious in the beginning, but they're actually doing, they're working together well now. It's really useful. The links, obviously, from primary to secondary are very good. I mean, we had very good relationships with the GPs anyway, but it was always on paper. And they'd say, oh, well, so that's who you are, you know, you're just always just a signature at the bottom of a letter, you know. So it's nice we've opened the doors and got familiar with people and seeing people's faces. And I think it's nice that we've got a much more relaxed approach. You know, they're picking up a phone and speaking to the nurse. They're getting sort of direct information from the clinic, that sort of thing. You know, we've sort of, like, broken down the barriers a bit, which is really good. I wouldn't say a lot of case conferencing goes on at the moment. We'd like to work towards that, but it's something that we would really like to do. Perhaps a GP could call in the nurse, perhaps with one of the consultants, and maybe discuss a very difficult problem or case, you know, something that's been very worrying. And I think get that multidisciplinary as well. It's certainly a real potential in doing that. The nurses are making direct referrals to surgical day unit for epidurals or facets where they see it's appropriate. So with the choose and book system and the sort of direct booking that, once again, is another target we have to meet, that can happen so patients can actually get put straight onto a waiting list for that. And because these are the nurses that are working with the consultants in the clinic, the consultants are very confident about the decisions they make to do that, which perhaps they wouldn't be if it was, say, a primary care, a community nurse who'd been trained in pain management. They wouldn't have quite the same understanding and relationship about making that decision. And we just find that really now that the referrals that are coming into secondary care are far more appropriate. We've met our 13-week target, fortunately, and we have to get down to 11 weeks soon. And I think we have to get to 6 weeks in the next couple of years, so watch this space. But fortunately, the patients that are coming in are probably the ones that need to be in secondary care. But the only thing is, the consultant's saying now, we never see a simple pain patient, they're all complicated. So, of course, the nurses are creaming off about the 30% that are much more simple. The other support to primary care staff is really starting to grow. Things like patients, once they have been discharged home and still have difficult dressings, they may be still on the opiate route and they may be sort of titrating or they may be moving down the opiate route. But things like using Entonox, we get a lot of calls from district nurses to say, you know, what do we do with a patient who needs dressings doing regularly and has got too much pain? We're finding also that we're managing to get patients out of hospital quicker by saying, send them out, the district nurses could use Entonox and some Oromorph or whatever for doing dressings, and that support is out there with the primary care nurse. And there's a big audit trail going on, obviously, because we need to look at what we're doing and is it working, and we think it is. And I've got a little bit of data in a minute to show you. Anybody really can refer to the primary care nurse. The GPs are the biggest referrers, obviously, but district nurses can probably refer to the primary care nurse and basically for advice on all pain management, whether it's cancer, acute pain, post-operative, post-trauma, whatever. But it's usually the GPs. But the nice thing is as well that we're actually referring from secondary care. So if our acute pain nurses working on the wards are getting patients home and they perhaps start them on opiates or gabapentin or something and they've got some concerns about them going home, they'll get them seen in the clinic in primary care. And the way it works at the minute, for example, is there'll be three clinics in various localities around a PCT. So for nearly our two nurses, there'll maybe be sort of, no good naming the areas, probably don't mean very much to you, but they'll be probably in areas maybe sort of 10 miles apart around, so maybe three sessions a week, either morning or afternoon, they'll actually have a clinic. So what we would do is just sort of see the nearest clinic to this patient's home and get that patient seen there. So the GP is happy with that. We send a letter to say that they will be reviewed in the primary care clinic. And everybody seems quite happy with that. And we found that they're managed quite appropriately with that. Inclusion and exclusions. What we like to see in the primary care clinic is acute pain from early surgical discharge. The chronic pain, chaps with the lower backs, most spinal pain really, with or without any radicular components, but with have a diagnosis. Undiagnosed pain we prefer to see in secondary care. And neuropathic pain, if it's things like diabetic neuropathies and that sort of thing. Cancer patients, no, unless they've just been referred for something like TENS or a sort of a localised pain. Paediatrics, obviously, are an exclusion. They're a bit more specialised. And patients with any psychiatric disorders are not suitable either. And sort of sudden onsets of sort of radicular type pain, we would prefer to go into secondary care as well. Thinking of some of the early evaluations, looking back a bit now and sort of deciding where we've gone with this and what's worked and what hasn't. The triage debate is really, we were looking at the beginning, I think some of the GPs in the early days felt that was it appropriate that the nurses triaged the referrals, because they were used to sending their letters to consultants, and presumably, obviously, the consultants looked and decided where those patients needed to go and should they be seen as a routine or urgently or whatever. Some referrals do still slip through and end up going directly to the consultants, and that's fine, because everybody works quite closely together. But I think they're getting comfortable now with the nurses doing the triage, and because of this issue of the PCTs triaging all referrals, it's actually better for us that the pain nurse does them. It means that we actually remain in control of our own patients. The activity, I suppose the referral patterns are still a little bit erratic. Some GPs are really in with it and they're sending lots of patients. Some of them are still actually sending inappropriate ones, so although they've got referral guidelines, I think they just think pain and yes, you can be seen in the primary care clinic. But I'm sure that'll settle down. Some of the therapies are following the clinical management plans, but they're going to go, and really the nurses will be not free to do what they wish, but they will still work within sort of a plan, but it won't have to be a written plan. And we're looking at both GP and patient satisfaction, and that's evaluating well at the moment. Is it cost effective? Yes, it is, because it costs probably around the total cost for a year is probably around about £40,000. That's for half the time of a nurse specialist. Well, actually, that was with some physio and GP time, so it's probably slightly less if you don't have other disciplines included. But the half-time of a nurse specialist really costs around about £18,000-£20,000, and then about another £7,000-£8,000 for secretarial support, and then probably another £5,000 for sort of TENS and travelling and other added expenses. So between about £30,000-£40,000 is really all it costs, which is actually cost-effective, we think, for the amount of patients that are being seen. Will it survive? Well, it has done so far, and we're into our second year now. And I think the clinics are very busy. There's lots of patients being seen. A bit of early outcome data. This is done about 6 months ago, so we've moved on a lot since then. But out of the first 77 patients that were seen over about the first 9 months, majority were spinal pain, other musculoskeletal pain, some neuropathic pain, and some post-amputation. So the majority of them were spinal pain. And the main therapies were TENS, and a large proportion were educational advice, which was, you know, came out as quite a useful thing to do, really. There was hardly any intervention with drugs or anything. Patients just needed that, the sort of support and understanding and the confidence to continue with their lifestyle. And 36% requiring some sort of medication. And that's the outcome, which is really good. 64% discharged out of that 77, so that's very high discharge rate. At that particular time, that was. And then 13% are still ongoing within that particular system, and about 23% referred on to secondary care. And that's part of the plan, that the nurse would see them a couple of times, and if she felt that her plan, her therapy wasn't, the patient wasn't progressing, then she would find a point when she referred into secondary care. And that seems to be working quite well. But a large proportion, the majority of the patients, are actually discharged. So the nurse is managing the whole caseload from referral to discharge. So just to conclude, I think what it's telling us really is that many patients can be managed in primary care, providing you've got a robust model. You've firstly got to set up your service and then sustain a robust model and a plan of how you're going to do that. But it has demonstrated that a lot of patients can be managed satisfactorily much earlier. It's got to be cost effective to the continued expansion of secondary care. And we found there's greater compliance with the chosen therapies because of earlier intervention. The DNA rates are low. Patients sustain their medication and their information, and they stick with their chosen therapy, which often doesn't happen when they've waited months to come back to a secondary care clinic. I think the expectations are more realistic because patients don't come with expecting operations or injections when they're just seen in primary care. Sometimes by the time they get to the secondary care clinic, they're almost disappointed that you're not going to stick a needle in them or that they're not going to get an operation. So I think they accept that things can be done simpler, and they're happy with that. And as I said, we were doing some satisfaction audit, which at this particular time is still ongoing. But we know that both from the patients and the GPs, anecdotally, that they are hugely satisfied with it. And meetings that we've done with GPs have actually said, yes, it's great, even if it's only somewhere to send the heart sink patient. And they are very, very happy with what we're doing. So thank you very much. That's all I've got to say. Thank you. Yes, if anybody would like to ask any questions, I'll do my best to answer them. Yes.
Do you ever use PCT pharmacists to do any work?
Well, I'm glad you raised that question, because in actual fact, the pharmacist is a very important part of the team as well, or in addition to the team. We don't actually use them to do any of the work, but there's a lot of work being done in conjunction with the pharmacist. They were very helpful and supportive in sort of setting out some of the guidelines that went into some of the written information. And I think, once again, a little bit like the physiotherapist, there was some initial concern that I think that there was going to be a lot more prescribing and a bigger, heavier use of drugs. But I think they've realised that the nurses work within use a broad formulary, they don't use a medication anywhere near as much as is used in secondary care. And they're quite confident now that the nurses aren't there just to sit and write out prescriptions.
So in Glasgow we've got about 30 prescribing support pharmacists that do reviews in practices.
Right.
Already.
That's excellent. I think that would be really good. Looking at the sort of triangle, the pyramid there, when we looked at the sort of self-care model, I think that's where pharmacists would really be very, very helpful, because patients should be encouraged really to go and speak to a pharmacist and get some sort of first-line information about how to use a combination of just paracetamol and ibuprofen or something like that. A lot of patients don't have that basic understanding of managing their own pain with simple medication. So I think pharmacists have got a big role to play in primary care pain management. Yes.
Yes.
Oh gosh, I think it's something about 195,000 in one of the. I'm not sure if that's across the board in one of the PCTs. Sorry, my geographical understanding isn't that good. I should have come a bit more prepared. There was, if I put it down into practices, in one PCT there is 17 practices, and in another one there's 31 practices. So it doesn't give a lot of time to a particular practice. The accommodation side of it was one of the most difficult things to sort out, because when we started to look at where we would hold these clinics, all the GPs said, well, we'd love it, but you can't do it here. So there was a number of health centres and a number of like sort of little cottage hospitals that we managed to find rooms in. And what happens is, if it is in one of the PCTs, it's done in a GP surgery, but it doesn't mean that it's only for those patients at that surgery. The GPs from other places can refer in. But it would be nice, as I was saying earlier, to see those GPs actually develop some sort of pain management clinic. You know, they have Well Woman Clinic and, you know, obesity clinics and all this sort of thing. It would be nice if they had, even just once a month for an afternoon or something like that, to have somewhere where patients could go to have their TENS reviewed, a medication review or whatever, to free up the nursing time to go and do the more intensive stuff elsewhere. So, yeah, 31 surgeries in one area, 17 in another. So it's quite a big workload, really. Yep.
Can I just ask, you were saying that one of the motivations for this is to obviously cut down referral times.
Mm-hmm.
The patients who are referred on from the primary care,
yes,
they pick up the same delays into secondary care, or are they
fast-tracked? No, they don't. They're fast-tracked in. That was one of the conditions with the PCTs, that these patients wouldn't then be seen in primary care. And we felt the same. We didn't want them to be seen quickly in primary care, to tick a box to say they've been seen, then have to wait a long time to come to secondary care. So if the nurse is not managing to deal with their pain after a couple of appointments, then we can get them straight into secondary care. And that hasn't happened a great deal, I have to say. I think it's it must be testimony to the fact that the referral guidelines must be working, because obviously they're picking up the right referrals and they're managing to deal with them themselves. So, but any patient that needs to be seen from primary care quickly can go on to, can be moved on and seen probably as an urgent rather than a routine.
You mentioned the ongoing audit. I just wondered what outcome measures you're using.
Well, we're obviously using pain reduction, function, things like mood, sleep. The girls haven't really defined any. They're looking at the whole spectrum, really, of the sort of outcome measures that we would use probably in secondary care. But I think the biggest thing for primary care really is to look at sort of obviously patient satisfaction with their pain reduction, because really it's not that quantifiable. I mean, some patients are happy with a 50% reduction, some people want 100% reduction. So it's about their satisfaction with what they get, really, and how quickly they move really from a static point of where they felt they needed help to actually back to normality. So it's perhaps difficult to quantify, really, because all patients' expectations will be different. So I think at the moment they're looking at pain reduction and return to work and things like that.
You mentioned early education.
Yes.
Education of the patient.
Yes, the actual point of early education was around the patient education, and I think with the outcome data there was about 23% of patients who were discharged following just having simple advice, just understanding that their spine wasn't crumbling and things like that, that they could actually still carry on doing activities, that the combination of simple analgesics was sufficient for them or whatever, or that they could carry on taking whatever particular drug for the rest of their lives if they needed to, you know, they didn't have to go looking for something else. So I think their understanding at that early point was actually crucial. And once they've got that information on really one appointment, assessment, discussion of their concerns, that's going to be fine for you. Fine, I'm okay, I can live with that now. And I think there was quite a significant proportion of patients who felt that just having that particular one-to-one with a specialist was enough for them. and we call that education because nothing else really happened.
Just following on from that, do you think there's a group of people who need a bit more than that? You know, some kind of a brief education program?
Definitely. We have pain management programs within secondary care. And I don't know about you, but we in secondary care tend to put them through everything else and then put them on a pain management program, and they say, oh, well, if we'd had this in the beginning, perhaps I wouldn't have had to go through all of that. And I think that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. What we were finding was that if we probably put the patients in maybe a sort of a cognitive behavioural sort of approach to their condition earlier on, they actually sort of realised, they managed their expectations a bit better, they realised that just going on a shopping trip around the clinic for various interventions isn't the way to manage their pain. So maybe not a pain management programme, but maybe sort of back care groups or getting active on prescription is another thing that we're doing in our area. And there's another group called Action on Pain. And it's really about just like-minded people, people who've got pain problems, just having that bit of fundamental support through non-professionals, really. And once again, that seems to be the way forward. I think it's the sort of mindset of people in our area, I don't know, but they seem to find that if they've got some sort of peer support, they can cope, really. And whether we call it a pain programme or whatever, I don't know, but I think that's probably one of the things that we're going to look at. And I think the limiting factor really is the time that the nurse has got at the moment, because the clinics have become very busy, and the slot she's got that's for education, so to speak, is that one session a week. So it's about trying to get something set up. And I think we feel also that that group or whatever it happens to be shouldn't really be run by professionals. You've got to try and get it going and then move out and leave those patients or those people to get on with it, really. And Action on Pain, which is a national thing, I don't know whether you've used it here in Scotland, but they came down to talk to us and they've set up a group in Middlesbrough, and that was all a spin-off from primary care as well. So people can be directed onto other places like that. So you don't feel that you have to resource it yourself, but you can actually sort of set it going and let them, it sort of self-managed by the patients.
Can I ask two questions?
You can.
The first one is, I noticed that one of the things the nurses do in primary care is they use some cognitive behavioural treatments,
mm-hmm.
approaches. How trained are they in that, and how do the psychologists feel about the nurses doing the psychologists in secondary care?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question.
Second question,
right.
is, to give you time to think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
The second one is, the nurses, how big a caseload does each nurse have for primary care, and are they subject to the same waiting time constraints as the secondary care staff?
Okay. Answer to your first question, very, very good question with regard to their experience in managing cognitive behavioural. One of the nurses, both of the nurses have worked on pain management programmes in secondary care alongside the psychologist. So I think they both feel that they've got a number of skills, and one of the nurses still does. One of her roles within secondary care is the pain management programme. And they've done courses, they've done in-house courses. They're not psychologists and they don't allude to be psychologists, but they've got a very good relationship with our clinical psychologist. He's done actually education sessions with them. And I think they're basically, as most nurses in a professional sense, they know their boundaries. And I think they know that when a patient is beyond the remit in terms of managing their psychological support, then that would be the time to perhaps refer on to secondary care. So I think nurses who've worked in pain management for a number of years develop a lot of skills in terms of being intuitive, in being able to manage the simple psychological issues that patients present with, and being able to identify when there's something more severe or sinister going on and that have to refer into them. So I think they've just basically got that understanding of their limitations. And our psychologist supports them fully. I think he's so overworked in secondary care that I think he's very keen and very supportive of any sort of efforts that they're making in primary care. But one of the exclusion criteria is that anybody with any psychiatric disorder would be excluded, and if there's significant psychological problems identified, then they would be sent on in. So I hope that answers your first question, and I can't remember what the second one was now.
The caseload.
The caseload, the waiting times, we we said that they'll be seen within 2 to 4 weeks. But we've just we put that as a benchmark to begin with, and we really had nobody to compare it with. But looking at the potentially number of referrals, we reckoned about 30% of referrals. So we were reckoning on having, at that time, we had 1,300 new referrals into secondary care. We felt about 20 to 30% could be managed in primary care. And given that the nurse has 3 clinics a week, each seeing about 6 patients, so there's potentially sort of 15, 18 patients a week is what her caseload is. And most of them are sort of fairly fast-tracked and discharged fairly quickly. She's probably carrying the same number of patients for a number of weeks. But given that if things aren't getting any better, she would move them in, she doesn't carry them for that long, really. No, they don't have waiting times imposed on them, because that's only imposed on consultants at the moment. Any nurse clinics don't have a target. But whether they'll become targeted in the future, we'll have to see. It might be a good idea if they do, because then the PCT would have to reinvest in them, I guess, if there was a target, because if they had to meet certain waiting times, it could be beneficial in some respects. But at the moment, what we're doing is we've established a sort of a capacity, really, based on the number of patients they see per week. And I suppose if the waiting times do go beyond about 4 weeks, we'd have to review it, because it's no point saying that we're trading ourselves on early intervention and simple advice, etc., if they can't be seen for 10 weeks. They may as well come to the secondary care clinic, where it's soon to be 11 weeks. So I think it's something that we're not entirely still sure about. They can meet the 2 to 4 week target at the moment, which we've imposed ourselves. And if it goes beyond that, well, we have to have a rethink. Any further questions? Well, thank you very much for...
I beg your pardon.
Right.
I've actually got 10 questions for...
Fire away.
It's too relieved here. I'm not going to ask any.
Oh, that's great.
I feel no.
Not at all. I really don't mind.
You've been put some ill this evening. There's just one comment I was going to make, and that is that appearance by results doesn't affect Scotland.
Right, how lucky for you.
It's going to come in right. The 1st of January 2008 in England, isn't it? And, there is a cautionary tale from that, isn't there, from what you're saying?
Well, there is, yes. Well, it's actually going to happen in this next financial year. Yeah. We're actually currently, I've just been working with my clinical director doing the service specification to make sure we've got in a fully inclusive list of everything we offer and all the conditions that we see. And Dr. Milligan is on the Council of British Pain Society, and he's been working on the health resource groups, the HRGs, and that's where you've got tariffs then for consultations, the interventions, and everything's tariffed in there through to the pain management programme, TENS, and this sort of thing. Everything's in there. So the good news is that if we do it, we'll get paid for it. But the concerning thing is, as I said earlier, that if the PCTs say, "Well, we'll do it somewhere else," thank you very much, then we don't get paid for what we do, or we don't get paid, and we have to look at then, can we sort of sustain the establishment of staff that we've got? And it's quite scary, really, to think what might be happening, because we've just built up our service and then rationalise it out into primary care, and now we might be looking at thinking, do we need to bring it all back again to protect our service, really? Yeah. It's just a cautionary note. I'm not really sure. I don't want to be scaremongerish, but we were just a little bit alarmed to think that PCTs can now turn around and say, well, we'll treat these patients elsewhere. So you never know. Watch this space. It's a fast-changing world at the minute.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what you've done in leading it from secondary care is hugely important, isn't it, particularly because we've always prided ourselves in multi-professional.
Yes.
And I think to keep the link so that it's not single-handed people, it's like 10 o'clock about 20 years we start doing single-handed people without proper links.
I agree.
In a multi-professional way.
Yes.
The other comment you made earlier on about the complexity of the pain from between the hospital walls is also relevant, doesn't it?
Oh, it's, yes.
Work,
yes.
Acute and chronic.
Yeah. It is, and I think for the nurses in the audience, I mean, I don't know how long you've been in pain management, but when I came into pain management 12 years ago, I came in as an acute pain nurse, and I would just see post-operative patients. And now the nurses I bring in to work in the clinic, they have an understanding that their job description will be around acute and chronic, and learning both, because one interacts with the other. Because the wards really, we've trained the ward staff really, we've trained the doctors. I mean, there's a huge understanding now of managing acute pain in hospitals, and we have the technology and the drugs to do it. protocols, etc. It drives itself, really. So the nurses on the wards pick up complex patients, and we see it in the notes a lot. The consultant will do a ward round, say refer to pain team and discharge, and that's what they expect us to do. I'm still trying to think of a way at the minute as how to get money out of the various specialties who do that to us, you know. And that's my next project, I guess. So,
anyway, thank you very, very much indeed.
Thank you. Well, thank you for bearing with me.
Sure, greatly appreciate it. Thank you.